You're listening to the Youth Critic Podcast on KHZ Network. Find us on Facebook at DecibelUNG Radio and find us on Twitter at DecibelUNG. If you like this episode, please leave a like and comment on our iTunes page at KHZ Network.
Yo, I'm out. Stay out of my fucking room.
And now for the podcast.
Today, man.
Looks cool to me.
I'm moving.
Stevie.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Youth Critic Podcast. I am your host, Kale Smith, and joining me today is Gina Versa.
Hello, how are you doing? Just woke up.
Doing good. Good. So today, Gina and I, so what happened was on Tuesday, just to go over it real quick, on Tuesday night, I believe, we were trying to record an episode of Overlord Review, and it did not work. We had some sound issues. It was a very lively discussion, as you'll see as we, you know, re-talk about Overlord again. Yes, and because of that, we've had scheduling issues all week to try and get back and redo the show. To make it up to you guys, to make it up to you, the listeners, we are going to be talking about mid-90s as well as Overlord. They are two completely different movies, but they're two movies that Gene and I would love to talk about, so let's start with the one that's been out a lot, or the most, mid-90s.
Yes.
Gene, what did you think of mid-90s?
I thought for a directorial debut, it was such a strong voice coming from Jonah Hill. I really didn't suspect he had that in him. No offense to Jonah Hill, he crafted such a well-told tale, and it has it's funny, and it feels very cinema verite, I guess is the term. We really feel like you're living there with the kid. The actor Steven. Or excuse me, Sonny, I forgot his last name, damn it.
Sonny Sajak, I think.
Yeah, he's just great. I loved every scene he's in, because he just it doesn't feel like he's acting, it just feels like he is that kid, and he's very inhabiting that role, even though the role is a character that, you know, in the 90s, where it's just couldn't know anyway, but just feels like he just really inhabits it. And it was just, it had a lot of feels, if you will, where it's just, so many scenes just making, made me feel just a whole lot just watching it. I mean, I wouldn't say I cried or something, but you empathize with a lot of those characters and the social classes they were in.
For me, I get into mid-90s. It took me a while to just kind of get in the rhythm and kind of figure out what Jonah Hill was doing, mm-hmm. per se, because on one hand, it is a nostalgia piece about the 90s and about that particular moment where skater culture was ramping up. However, I don't think I got it until I'm pulling a name. Come on. It wasn't until I think it was Ray, the character of Ray, who gave that kind of that speech that what I call the Quint speech. There's all, mm-hmm. you know, when there's, you know, a speech where characters are talking and you get to know them more personally, yeah. exposition and whatnot. He has a, when Ray has the Quint speech with Sonny Sajak's character, Stevie, or it's Soljic. I've been, whatever, with yeah. Stevie. And where we learn about each of the characters and how each of the characters are kind of all together because they're either part of an abusive family or they're neglected or yeah, they're just kind of they all use this kind of what is, you know, essentially the sport slash art form that is skating to kind of get away from it all, to get away from, you know, the abuse of growing up, the abuse of growing up, you know, in, you know, from parents who are, you know, from who are, you know, basically they, from parents who kind of assimilated into the Reagan era of it all, the Reaganomics of the 80s.
Right. So I would say, yeah, it's still going on in the 90s, or it was.
Mm-hmm. Well, these are the children that are most affected by that. Because they're all, because I mean, they're all like, you know, they're all like, you know, late 70s, early 80s born ish.
Yeah.
So they're the ones that are most affected by the, you know, the impact of going back to the, you know, the culture that Reagan promised.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, it'll trickle down eventually.
What?
It'll trickle down eventually.
Yeah, it does. And in
no,
all,
no, it does not.
Right. Yeah. in what I'm kind of getting to is in the end, it's mid-90s is more of a deconstruction on where toxic masculinity comes from. And it comes from people who were abused, not only abused and neglected, but also were told that, you know, being emotional, being a, you know, kind-hearted and well-mannered person was not masculine. It was not.
Right. Exactly.
It was not. Yeah.
And that's why I really like that scene with him. And some people have not taken offense to it, but I feel like for some, maybe it's a little shocking, maybe off-putting. So, I mean, that's certainly understandable. But the scene where he's trying to like strangle himself with the wires is just kind of what happens when you like push down all these emotions for a while and it just comes out.
Yeah. Absolutely. When you just hold it in too long and then it all comes a bit of rage and emotion and and that's kind of how I view the movie is mm-hmm. It's a deconstruction of what happened like children that grew up in the Reagan era, and how they came up and how they became, you know, and how they basically formed themselves and how it kind of created this culture where they did, you know, as much as they could to break out into, you know, be, you know, I'm kind of blanking on the word, rebellious against their parents.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of led to that culture. And and I felt like that, and I feel like that is ultimately the goal, although I still have no idea what to take from the ending in that, you know, maybe there is a hope that that generation will stick together, that will always help each other out in the worst of circumstances. They all understand each other.
Yeah. Yeah, like that.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. Gene, do you have more to say on mid-90s before we go into spoilers? Because there's a couple specific scenes I wanted to bring up.
No, I don't think I have anything to bring up right now.
Okay. So I wanted to bring up, because I actually ran into a colleague of mine who did see mid-90s when I saw it, and he brought up the scene where Stevie loses his virginity to a 17, 18-year-old girl.
Yes, I believe so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's just very obvious that one is almost an adult and one like looks like a kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's and in the movie you don't see the actual sex, but it is still uncomfortable where it goes.
Yeah, it's implied and all that.
So my question for you, Gene, is how did you take that scene? Because for me, it matters more what happened to us.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that last thing?
What did you think about that scene in general? Because for me, it's more about what happened afterwards more than what happened in that moment.
Sure. It certainly was a little bit uncomfortable, probably based on, the kid's age and what have you. I would agree with you. It feels like it did. I mean, it was uncomfortable, but it did fill the narrative where this kid, he's just a kid and he's looking for all these, he's looking for all this kind of like affection or, not adoration, but he's looking for just care basically. And sometimes it's just like in all the wrong places, because it's just like he's from this like abusive household. And it almost, I hate to like say it's like some like Freudian thing, but like, almost like he's looking for like a mom's love almost. Because it is this like older person, so you could certainly see it as that. I won't dwell too much on that. It's kind of gross, but I would say.
Well, I was just going to say, like, he's looking for a paternal figure, because it's very clear that
his dad's not in the picture.
You know, father's not in the picture. And it's very, and also, like, he finds that in Ray and the other kids, and that these are men who are really cool, and I really want to learn how to be, cool as them, even if I have to, lose some of my well-manneredisms, because he is a good kid at the start of this movie. Like he's a well-intentioned kid. But by the end of it, like he kind of is still a well-intentioned kid, but he's a lot more different than when we first met him.
Yeah. Yeah. He's almost like seen it all from his side. Yeah, he certainly has some of his innocence taken away.
Yeah. And the reason why I say after that moment when Stevie loses his virginity, the reason why it's a lot more important what happens is because the whole scene, he's kind of gloating around, or he's kind of talking to this girl, and he's saying like, "No, I'm a different person. I'm not the kind of person that will, just gloat about losing my virginity at like age 11 or 12, whatever."
Yeah.
And then after he does it, he essentially just like almost like screams it out to the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And it says a lot about the immaturity of it, the immaturity of losing your virginity at such a young age.
Mm-hmm.
So, and yeah, and look, yes, the scene itself, it is a little, it is very cringeworthy, but I give Jonah Hill credit that he knew when to cut away.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, and I honestly think that, you know, Jonah Hill had the right intentions when he made that scene. It's not like he wanted to exploit this kid or this girl,
yeah.
but I think he wanted to show what happens when you lose something that monumental to a child or to a person at such a young age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I agree. I think you said it very well.
Yeah. And then the other scene I wanted to mention is there's a really good car crash scene at the end of this movie that's really effective with that jump scare, like the car is, you know, jumping, is blaring past them, and then the second time it happens, we cut to black, and then the car is...
Yeah, that was a really good thing of editing right there, because it was like, you're almost kind of like, what? And then it just happens, like it foreshadows it. That was very, like, it made the scene even more tense than it was.
Yeah, it is a really good foreshadowing, but I love that it just puts us on edge because we know in that moment that fuck shit. Yes, that's the character's name.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. We know that fuck shit is drunk and he is, you know, and he's the only one that can drive, but he's driving everyone to this party. There's an argument that's happening because no one wants to go to the party, but fuck shit wants to go because he doesn't want to go home. And it's everything that's been building. You mentioned him trying to strangle himself earlier, but this is the culmination of everyone. Particularly, fuck shit is, you know, reaching his boiling point of, you know, hiding all these emotions inside of him.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, and it causes his car to crash and Stevie to basically have a massive concussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they almost die.
Yeah. It's really well done, and honestly, like, the ending itself of everyone coming together, it's a little too happy, but there's something really positive about how that ends, where everyone is just, like, at the hospital waiting, and they all go and see him, and they're all there for him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really positive ending, and on top of a movie that is basically just about toxic masculinity in its formation.
Yeah.
So, Gene, is there any more to say on mid-90s?
No, I don't think so. You said it pretty well yourself.
Okay. So with that said, do you want to move on to Overlord?
Months ago, I was cutting grass in my front yard. And the mailman shows up with a letter from the army. Now I'm here. No idea where I'm gonna end up.
Here we go!
All right. Overlord. So, Gene, you described the Overlord plot last time. Do you mind doing it like one more time?
Okay. Well, without spoiling too much, is the next J.J. Abrams film that's produced by Bad Robot, and it's not a Cloverfield movie. Thankfully, it's a original pulp World War II zombie film, and it's a movie that you think you know, but it just keeps kind of throwing its shit around. This is so what J.J. Abrams' film should be. Like, I get it didn't have too much of a mystery box going on, and sometimes that's, like, I don't mind that if he doesn't overuse it, but it is, it's just so well done. It is what it is. It's like a full film. Knew what I was getting into going in. People kept telling me it wasn't a Cloverfield movie. I was like, oh, okay. I hope they're right. I mean, yeah, sure, I believe them, but yeah, I enjoyed it. That it just stuck to its guns. And hey, it's like, this is a zombie World War II movie, and you're going to see that in all its glory. So that's how I would describe it.
The way I would describe Overlord is it's a lot, there are fun moments. The opening 15 minutes where they're on the plane, and then we kind of get to know everyone, and we get to know the mission, and on top of that, we get the stakes, because we know that D-Day is like right around the corner. Like, I think it's the next morning.
Yeah.
So
basically.
So yeah.
Like cramming.
So basically.
They're like cramming the night before they're studying.
Yeah. Way to go, US. You put it off till the last minute. but yeah, so they have literally hours to blow up a tower. So the troops can come through the channel and cross, their way to Normandy. Mm-hmm. So we know the mission, we know everything, and then the plane crashes. Our main character, Boyce, is trying to get out of the plane, and he barely makes it out alive. and it's just chaos, and then we get on the ground, and we stumble upon a village, another person dies. Mm-hmm. And then we finally get to Nazi mutant zombies an hour into the movie.
Yeah, I think you did have some complaints. Not complaints, but some critiques on that. And I mean, that certainly could have been plotted a little bit better, but... I mean, it makes you care about these people. Excuse me. It makes you care about these people, so it's like, it didn't bother me too much. I felt that the suspense of the film was certainly in the air, so it more than made up for that, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'll say I really do love how the movie opens, but it just goes a little too long. And I feel like, because I feel like the opening does such a great pushing who's who, what everything, like everything I just said, like everything that's going to happen, because the opening, it does such a great job. I feel like, we can kind of expedite a lot of stuff, so we can get to like the real, not say the real plot of the movie, but let's get to like the real, let's get to like, oh, there's much more going on here than, we had to do everything in the first 30 minutes. I'm saying like within the first, before we get to the end of the hour, like, let's go ahead and get on with things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we're basically stuck at that house for like over an hour of this movie.
Yeah, I see that, but I'm not really too bothered when it gets kind of like play-like in a film. Like, to me, those are some of the most tense scenes of the film, where they're just in the house. It's very Reservoir Dogs-esque, almost. Like, oh shit, they had like a Nazi stash with them, and some shit might happen. That's I don't know. I enjoy that as a bit of screenwriting.
I mean, it's not, none of it is awful. Like, this is not the worst. This is not a bad movie. The way I would kind of break this down is, I feel like, you know, yes, it's fine. Let's learn about the, you know, our Nazi villain. Mm-hmm. Let's learn, you know, that's fine that we have a character who basically, you know, please, even though it's very, very obvious to us, uh-huh. please, you know, the idea that he's, you know, 3 months ago that he was just mowing his lawn, and now, like, he's basically on the front lines in this very important mission.
Right.
And if he and his crew don't succeed, everything goes tits up. So, yeah, so it's nice to have characters like that. It's because that's kind of true to how the drafting worked. It, you know, you got drafted, you trained for a few weeks, and then you got thrown into the lion's den.
Yeah, that was, yeah, you were putting that up awesome. That certainly was interesting.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if this is the kind of movie to deconstruct World War II, deconstruct how all of that came to be. And if, even if it, because this movie is trying to be pulpy, but it also is like, let's have a serious discussion about how World War II affected everyone, or affected, mm-hmm. you know, all these members.
Mm-hmm.
While also in this, you know, last 30 minutes, we basically become a crazy George A. Romero movie.
Yeah.
George A. Romero mixed with Stuart Gordon. So.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we needed it, but I feel like we could have had just more, like, just trim it down to like from an hour 50 to 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. Had a good clean. I feel like on IMDb it was an hour 50, oh. And when I did leave my theater, it was like with previews. It was like I was in there for over 2 hours.
Yeah, right.
So I'm assuming it's more closer to the hour 50 than the hour and 33 that Bendigo had it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, I just felt like, just kind of like, let's just get into it and have fun, and let's have a gory mess. I mean, I feel like Quentin Tarantino has made more gorier movies than this.
Oh, I'm sure he has.
Like, even recently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and that was my other thing too, is when we finally got to like, oh shit, now our Nazi leader villain is like a mutant, and he's got all his face all fucked up. I'm like, it's a real, but there's not much else happening. I kind of wish this movie got more bonkers. Like, do you remember the scene? No, I won't do that. I'll say this. Okay. I wish the movie just got bloodier and gorier. Like, just more, like, fucking batshit insane.
I mean, at times, I do wish it did.
Yeah. Because Well, and I just wish it did, because there's just so many moments where I'm like, you know, shouldn't this guy who's been shot multiple times just be bleeding? Yes, it might be sliding out. Like, and also, this is an R-rated movie. Go at it. Go right. As close to the NC-17 as possible.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You don't. I have no idea why they didn't do that, but yeah, that certainly would have been appreciated. I think, like, if they made it more, I don't know, just like more bloody, something like that, to kind of like to kick up its ass or something.
Yeah, but I will say this though: Julius Avery has a career in filmmaking, because despite the script kind of just like meandering, or the narrative meandering itself, yeah, Julius Avery gets a lot of mileage out of his, you know, small budget and his character actors.
Yeah, he certainly does. Like all the, got a lot of mileage out of those characters with the like the Bronx dude, or I don't know where that guy was from. The New Yorkan character, you certainly felt
the Tippett.
Tippett, yeah. Yeah, he did. Certainly, he's a great character actor. John Magiro.
John Magaro.
Magaro, I don't know. And just Magaro. Everyone just did such a just well crafted performance. And Wyatt Russell is worth talking about, because he just really steals the show. I wish you're saying I wish he was more the center of the film, and that's certainly fair. Because he was channeling like Snake Plissken at times, like his dad, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, here's what I said in the last episode, and I'm gonna butcher this, so sorry. Jovan, who plays Boyce, he's really good for the character he's playing. Mm-hmm. However, I really think, because Wyatt Russell steals the scene, I felt like you kind of needed a Snake Plissken character to kind of lead it and charge it. Wyatt Russell is just giving a really good performance.
Yeah.
It's charismatic. It's, you know, demanding. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's authoritative. Mm-hmm. And also, like, it's really kind of cool, mm-hmm, to see him punch Nazis.
Yeah, that's certainly missing a lot in 2018.
Yeah, so I really dug his character and how he played it. And I feel like the movie probably would have had more energy if he was the lead. However, with that said, though, uh-huh, the more I think about it, it kind of matters that Boyce is the one to have that scene of discovery,
mm-hmm,
where he discovers the whole lab and everything, and the one person who hasn't been infected but is about to,
mm-hmm,
and he saves him. Like, it matters that character is there to do all that. So, and that's fine, but I don't know. Like, I maybe it's just because I want to see Wyatt Russell in more things, because I loved it. I really loved his, you know, little bit character in 22 Jump Street, where he's the jock that's friends with Channing Tatum.
Yeah, I think he was like Tank or something.
Yeah. Yeah, and
he's always good in his bit roles. I certainly liked him in Everybody Wants Some.
Oh, yeah. And he's like the stoner dude in that movie, right?
Yeah, basically he's almost like the same character.
Okay. I mean, he has versatility, and I wish he would get more stuff, because I mean, because I really haven't seen him in anything since Everybody Wants Some. Maybe, mm-hmm, I've missed some of his work, but yeah, I wish he was in more stuff.
Yeah, he's really charismatic, so certainly keep hiring him, random directors, and he had like the best performance in that his season of Black Mirror that came out 2 years ago.
And also he was in Ingrid Goes West, which I did not see, but I hear is a great movie.
Didn't see it.
I wish Wyatt Russell's in more things. Currently he's in this other movie called The Woman in the Window that's coming out, which is from Joe Wright. So maybe that will, maybe something will come of that.
So
I'm just gonna, you know, so we're just gonna be here riding the Wyatt Russell train for a while. So I really liked Wyatt Russell in it, and he was great. The only other things I can really think about is that and this is going to be the hot take of the episode, in that I still really liked the Cloverfield Paradox, and I liked it a little bit more than this movie.
Oh, no.
Hello?
I said, oh, no.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, Gene, you were actually, I think you were on the Cloverfield Paradox podcast.
Probably.
And I think you liked it. It's been months.
Yeah, I think
you are. Good.
No, I don't think that movie has aged too well, to be honest.
Maybe I should watch it again, because I mean I saw it twice actually in one whole day. Which was on accident. It was on accident because I decided to sleep after the Super Bowl, and then I went to like school early to watch it, and so I watched it and I really liked it, and then I went to my friend's D&D party that night. And we decided, like, the last thing we would do, since it was only like a 90-minute movie, we would watch it before we, you know, close out. And I still was like, yeah, I can see some issues, but this is still a fun movie. And to me, I think the reason why I like...
Sorry, I cut you off.
Yeah, it's fine. I think the reason why I love or like Claire Paradox a little bit more than this movie is I like just how batshit insane it is. And I feel like the reason why things are happening, and I think it's a good excuse to have, is that the fabric of reality in the Cloverfield Paradox has been broken, or it's been like, you know, out of sync, and reality's trying to like kick it back in. Like, but there's a spaceship that's from a different dimension in the way.
Mm-hmm.
So every time like something happens, like the guy, you know, pukes up all these worms, or Elizabeth Delepicki shows up, or the arm gets cut off and then it becomes sentient. Mm-hmm. I feel like those are just like the fabric of reality trying to kick back in.
Yeah. Random shit's happening.
So it's trying to kick back in, and for me that's a good enough excuse to be like, okay, let's just have Lovecraftian shit happen.
Right. It like quite goes all the way there.
What?
It never quite goes like so like incredibly Lovecraftian, I would say.
I mean, that's kind of fair, but it it gets there enough to, in my opinion, it gets there enough to just, it gets there enough to where there's the paranoia and there's enough there, but you're right. And honestly, it's still not that great of a movie because it still has the Cloverfield thing, which makes it even, which makes the whole even fabric of reality theory that I have even more complicated because now there's three different worlds that, you know, are now basically busted because of this whole paradoxical machine. So I totally get why people don't love it. And the Cloverfield aspect of that movie does not really work at all. And in fact, it complicated the whole entire premise.
Like if it could just have been a black hole film, I think we're kind of going off on a tangent, but if it could have just been like a movie like The Black Hole, the Disney movie, that would have been cool. But just all the Cloverfield elements just kind of pissed me off.
Yeah. I mean, this movie didn't test well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love Abrams.
Well,
it's like he needs to stop doing that.
Well, I think here's what I think. I would have loved to have seen this movie before, or what the cut was before it was Cloverfield-ized. I would have loved to have seen God Particle and see what that would have been. But in the end, I admire why they do it. However, if it doesn't work for, if you can't find a way to organically work in the movie, because even 10 Cloverfield Lane has that issue as well, as it tries to work in the Cloverfield stuff. But if you can't find a natural way in your movie to make it work, then don't do it. Just let the movie be what it is. And on top of that, all of these movies, including Overlord, they're not big budget movies. They're not, you know, I think Paradox is the only one that cost over $40 million.
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah.
So just let them, just let these movies be what they're meant to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then just release them. That's why
Overlord works for me.
Yeah. And Overlord won't make a lot of money, primarily because A, it didn't do well this weekend, and B, let's face it, everyone, fantastic this weekend. It's going to. Also, The Grinch is out.
Yeah. And
people want to see fucking Benedict Cumberbatch voice The Grinch along with.
But have Benedict Cumberbatch not voice Benedict Cumberbatch. It doesn't sound like him. Like, it sounds like Bill Hader.
I don't know, and I don't care. I gave up on Illumination. I will see a Dr. Seuss movie that's not produced by Illumination. But yeah, I just don't care about The Grinch. And honestly, viewers, I know you probably all want me to review The Grinch, but I just can't do. I can't. I won't see it. I just can't do it. I've seen the trailers in front of kid movies.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I can't do it. I can't do it.
Mm-hmm. No, of course. But yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It kind of sucks. It's the original movie, but yeah, I don't know what else to say about it.
Yeah. I would just say go check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Because I am still recommending this movie despite the padding being a big, you know, stick out for me, because this movie, it's still fun. And what I've noticed is the people that go in cold, like haven't seen a trailer and haven't, you know, been kind of, you know, embedded with the whole Overlord marketing campaign, like they just go in, okay, new J.J. Abrams movie, let's go check it out. And and they see it, like, they're the ones that love it more. So I would say go in as cold as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of hard after this listening to this podcast, but mm-hmm. I think if you have a friend that doesn't know that much about it, take him or her to see it. And see it with you, and then have a good discussion about, like, how much fun the pulpiness of it is.
Yeah, like we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, yeah, so.
I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, I think we've covered it. Gene, if we're all done here, don't you have a short film that you're making?
Yeah, it's called Vera OS. We're doing a crowdfunding for it. We're at almost 50% of our goal. You could find it on Indiegogo. If you go to my Twitter bio, it's just like a pinned tweet. So, yeah, just go Indiegogo, Vera OS. Yeah, you'll find it.
I'll put links in the description of this podcast. So, and please check it out. Please help and support Gene in all of his endeavors. And just please help out. And I cannot wait to see Vero. Is it Vero OS?
Yeah.
Okay, just checking.
Yeah.
So just go check it out. It's gonna be so. Check it out, and if you can't contribute anything, just please share it on all your social media platforms. You're welcome. And a little bit of Bear Gator update before we go. Mm-hmm. Bear Gator is officially wrapped. We're done filming. We finished last week. We're now in the editing. We have an assembly. We should have a new cut on Saturday. Or tomorrow, whenever cast. And we'll be done with the promo, hopefully by Christmas. But if not, we will release, we will share it on Vimeo and maybe YouTube. We have to kind of work out some things there with YouTube. But we will share it as soon as we can. But it will be out around either Christmas or January of 2019.
Yes.
And that's what we're looking at right now. I just saw the first cut. We definitely have enough to show people to get people excited. We got a promo, and that's what we're working on. So thanks everyone.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah. So, Gene, where can the good people find you?
You can find me, Gene9892, on Twitter and Instagram.
Okay. And you can find me on Twitter at MovieKale, or also known as the Newt's Commander Stan account, as my Twitter handle. And you can also follow me or follow the show at The Youth Critic, where I post updates and whatnot on the show from time to time. And also, you can follow the channel that distributes this podcast at KHC Network. Thanks, everyone. We will be back with you next week on Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, where we'll be examining the hijinks that Grindelwald and company get themselves into. It's going to be a fun for all comedy. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
What's behind that wall? What do you do with those people? They have been given a purpose.